And now it's time for the Sports Kings from Queens.
Hello, everyone. Today is Wednesday, June 12th. We are the Sports Kings from Queens. I'm Gino. I'm here with Kevin. That's right. We're only two-thirds of the Sports Kings from Queens. Darren taking some needed rest.
After 106 consecutive podcasts being part of, he is taking the night off.
Please listen to us anyway you get your podcast. Like, subscribe, follow us on Facebook. Take one of our post shirt with your friends. Get our posts out there. We want everybody to be a part of the show. Today on the show, we got the Celtics up 2-0 in the NBA Finals. We got the Florida Panthers up 2-0 in the NHL Finals. Yankees are playing some really great baseball. Mets are not, but they're trying to get back in this now. Scottie Scheffler, who has been dominating golf on the precursor right here as we get to the U.S. Open tomorrow. And we have a new Belmont Stakes champion in Dornoch who wins with a big finish. Dornoch had about a three-length lead down the stretch. Mindframe cut it to about a half a length with about two lengths left. He just didn't have enough. Sierra Leone comes in third. Anna Marie finished about four lengths behind everybody else in fourth. Dornoch paid $37.40 for the win on a $2 bet. Exacta paid on a dollar bet $163, and the trifecta paid about $236 on a 50-cent bet. I got one thing, just Kev, before you start getting into this, could Fox please fix their damn audio during the race? Their audio for this race was just horrible; it was atrocious. But tell us about the Belmont, Kev.
Well, this one, you know, Dornoch went off of the second longest shot. But 17-1, that's really not that long of a long shot. I mean, the longest shot was 19-1, and I think that was it Wine Stewart? Or I forget which one it was.
Wine Stewart.
It was Wine Stewart. You know, we said it last week on the podcast. You could make a case for any of the 10 horses, really.
Yep, without
really being out of left field. And I know Darren and I liked Antiquarian a little bit more. Am I shocked that Dornoch won? No. You know, he ran in the Kentucky Derby. That one, to me, if you run in the Derby, sometimes you have to throw out that race because it's 20 horses, and you're never, ever going to see 20 horses in the field except for that one race a year. So this race, you know, Caesar Gray got out to the lead just like he did in the Preakness. But in the Preakness, you know, I think with the muddy conditions in the Preakness, I think Caesar Gray was able to get to the top, control the pace. And with everybody in the back, you know, dealing with mud, and he's got a nice clean path. Nobody's kicking mud in his face. I thought he was very comfortable and was able to control it. This time around, they got out quick. He slowed it down for the second quarter there. I mean, when I looked up, and he was high 47s, almost 48 after running 22 and change. It was like, wow, he really slowed it down real nice.
Yeah, this wasn't a really fast pace.
But Dornoch stalked most of the way. Mindframe was sort of right in the pack there as well. And around the turn, you know, Dornoch finally passed Caesar Gray. Caesar Gray fell back from there. Mindframe looked like he was really poised. And when you take a look at the replay, maybe you saw it live, but on the replay, definitely you saw it. Mindframe, as you're heading down the stretch, he drifted out 4 or 5 wide for a while before, like, righting himself and coming back and really made a hell of a strong kick in the last furlong, closed that gap down to, you know, almost nothing. I think if he didn't drift out to start the stretch, I think Mindframe could have won. If this was, you know, a mile and this was a mile and a quarter, if this was a mile and 3/16, or 5/16, I think Mindframe actually catches him. I mean, I think Dornoch got a little bit lucky, the fact that Mindframe, Dornoch got lucky because Mindframe drifted out for a bit there. Sierra Leone got caught way too far back. I know he's a one run. He makes his one run from back, but, you know, with the pace not brutal, it's set up where the front end was not dying, where Sierra Leone could pick everybody off, and he had to settle for third.
Yep. Listen, I like Donna Marie. We talked about it. Darren made the point to me when he was picking his horses that after because I went and then you went and Darren was the last one. And Darren said, you know, gee, at a mile and a half, I would be more on Anna Marie with you. And you know what? The way he came on late in that race, Darren may have been right on the button with that, because at another quarter of a mile, Anna Marie may have really made this a race. You can see, because Anna Marie started way back.
Even further back than Sierra Leone.
Way back. And it just coming, as soon as they hit that stretch, you could tell he was making a run. He didn't have anything close to getting to Dornoch at that point, especially at a mile and a quarter, though. But it was a good race. It was a good race. Did you think it was a good race?
Yeah. Real solid, you know. Good job by Dornoch. Good job by, you know, stalking and letting Caesar Gray take control for a little while. Made his move when he had to and had enough to hold off Mindframe.
Yeah. Okay, next big race coming up is
Travers.
The Travers, that's right. Kind of weird, and I bring it up only because the two big races here are at the same place, because Saratoga hosted the Belmont Stakes this year, and now the big race that's usually at Saratoga, which is a Travers, will also be at the same track. We'll see if that matters. I'm not sure it's going to matter, but we'll see if that actually has any kind of impact in the race itself. So,
yeah, we'll see if guys like or forces like Dornoch and Caesar Gray and Mystic Dan, who just had nothing left.
Yeah,
we didn't mention Mystic Dan. You know, the third race in 5 weeks. He had no shot. Never a factor
in this one. Yeah, but no, listen, I brought it up because I thought it could be an interesting point. These horses now have raced there.
Yeah,
they've been at that track. So do you see some of these people, some of these horses from the Belmont come back up and try to win the Travers? You know what I mean?
I think no doubt about it. They will be there for the Travers, a lot of them. I wouldn't be surprised if at least half this field doesn't run in the Travers, and the fact that they've got the experience now over Saratoga's track helps them immensely.
Yeah. I completely agree. All right. We'll move over to the NBA. Boston is up 2-0. Game 3 taking place as we are recording this. And at the moment in game 3, Boston is up by 2. Boston won game 1 with an 18-point win. They won game 1 with game 2 with a 7-point win. Kev, you want to talk to us about the Celts?
Yeah, game 1, I mean, this game was over. First quarter, 37-20. At halftime, was 63-42. Could have turned your TV off there. Dallas was never in the game. And really, the biggest difference in this game was Porzingis. He was healthy in game 1. 20 points in 21 minutes, gave, you know, that real good third option. You know, Brown had his 22. Tatum, even though he only shot 6-for-16, had 16, 11 rebounds, 5 assists, contributed all around. Horford, 10, Holiday, 12, White, 15. I mean, you know, like we said, I thought when we did our preview last week, I said I thought the Celtics supporting cast beyond the top two was better than Dallas's. And in game 1 especially, Doncic put up his 30-10, Kyrie 12 points and 6-for-19, but only Washington and Hardy were in double digits.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that, because that's exactly where I was going to go, which is, you know, Boston played a man-to-man defense so well and forced Doncic to actually shoot. They forced him to do stuff with the ball because he couldn't pass to anybody. Nobody else was open. So by not double-teaming him, by not double-teaming Kyrie, nobody else was open. He only had one assist that game.
Yeah.
Luka had one assist the whole game. And when he only has one assist and Kyrie winds up only with 12 points, Dallas isn't winning. So, you know, but I thought that it was a good point by you with the other people on that team, because that's exactly what happened in that game. Porzingis definitely had an impact, so.
Game 2, you know, Doncic was much more on Doncic's game. He was 32, 11, and 11. He had the triple-double. Kyrie, again, struggled, only 7-for-18 for 16 points. A little bit more production outside. Washington is 17, Gafford 13, Jones 11. But again, I think the Celtics supporting cast helped them out. Brown, another 21, solid, you know, just like game 1. Mm-hmm. Shot the ball decently. You know, nothing wrong with what Brown was doing. Tatum, shot terribly, 6 for 22, yeah, but did a great job. You know, 18 points, but 9 rebounds and 12 assists.
Yeah.
He kept, you know, even though his shot wasn't falling, he kept in the game. He kept driving a lot, drawing the team, drawing the defense to him, and dished out for 12 assists.
Yeah. And listen, exactly that point. And again, they held Kyrie to only 16 points. I don't care how many Doncic has. If Kyrie only has 16, they're not winning that game. And, you know, Dallas, they were 6 for 26 from 3-point.
Yep.
I mean, so Boston defended the three. So Doncic got his assists that game, but Kyrie still didn't have anything. I mean, you know, in two games, he's got 12 and 16. That's not the winning recipe for Dallas. I mean, it's just not. So,
and shooting 13 for 37.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, we told the supporting cast. Now, in game two, much like it was Porzingis in game one, game two was Jrue Holiday stepping up.
Yep.
He scored 26, 11 for 14. Then White had 18. KP still chipped in with 12 before going out with his torn medial retinaculum. If that's even close to the way it should be pronounced.
It's all right.
It's the first time anybody in this entire country, unless you're a medical doctor, it's the first time anybody else has ever heard of this injury. So if I'm mispronouncing it, I'm sorry. But you've heard me 100 times on this podcast. You know I can't pronounce things.
Listen, I don't know. Listen, if I'm not a doctor either, and I don't know I can pronounce it correctly either. I mean, they actually put the graphic up about what he actually did. I still don't know what he did.
It allows a dislocation of the posterior tibialis tendon in his left leg. What that means, I have no damn clue. All I know is he's got a boo-boo on his left leg.
Yeah, that's it. And he's not playing in game three.
And enough not to play in game three.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know what? If you're not sure, if it's a question, you definitely, when you're up 2-0, going to game three, definitely hold him out. There's no sense to force him right now. And even game four, you probably don't even need to force him back.
Well, listen, I think game four comes down to what happened in game three, right? If you're up 3-0, you're not playing him, period, right? And if it's 2-1, you may not be playing him. It may be a toss-up.
You still got home court.
Right, but at 2-1, it's how good did we play? Do we really need him on the court for you know, let's call it half the game, 20 minutes, right?
Yep.
Is there a chance he could re-injure it coming back this quick? But if you're up 3-0, there's just no way he's playing. I mean, it's not happening. I'll tell you one thing I noticed, Kev, and I don't know if it's been happening the whole playoffs and I just didn't notice it, but game one, Celtics had 6 players with double-digit points, and in game two, they have 5 players with double-digit points. And if they're going to get production up and down the lineup like that, with or without Porzingis, I mean, you know, I know Porzingis was one of those, you know, guys, but if they're going to get that production and they're going to hold Kyrie below 16 points, they're going to win these games. I mean, I know I picked Dallas, but if they're going to play like that, they're going to win these games.
With the Celtics, with especially with Porzingis out there, he's 7'3".
Yeah,
and you look at the shooting numbers when he plays. Anything inside, he affects just by being 7'3". He's not. He may not be the greatest, you know, one-on-one defender, but just his length affects other players.
And because of his length, he may not have to be the greatest player out there.
Right. But when you look, you know, especially when he's out there, then, you know, between Tatum and Brown and White and Holiday, these are 4 guys that can really guard multiple positions. They're not stuck saying, I have to guard the 1, I have to guard the 4, and everything. They can switch around. So, you know, one of these plays where, you know, you're setting the screen for Doncic, you know, he can't, you know, when he comes around, he sets the screen. Well, guess what? He's still got another defender coming over on him that is still a solid defender.
Yeah. Listen, I agree with you.
And Boston doesn't lose a lot when they switch on the screens. And that's been the big key for them. They've been able to, you know, Doncic has his 30 points every game, but they've been, like you said, they've been able to hold down Kyrie to 28 points in two games combined, and not shooting well, and the rest of the team doesn't scare you.
Yeah, and exactly how you were putting it with the defense, right? When you have that many guys that can switch off on different players, you're not worried so much about, oh, damn, who's got Doncic, because somebody else has got Kyrie and you're okay with it. You know what I mean? Yep. You're not trying to make sure you keep somebody on here, on Luka, to make sure Luka doesn't torch you. And at the same time, leave Kyrie open. You're switching these guys off and on as much as you can, you know, as much as you have to, basically. So, yeah.
And the other big thing when Porzingis is out there, Horford is able to play realistic minutes. If Horford's out there for 24 to 30 minutes, he's still extremely effective at that level.
Agreed.
When Porzingis is out and when Horford has to start playing 35, 36, 38 minutes, that's when his, you know, 37 years old starts to come into play.
Listen, that's when you see his inefficiencies on the court because he's playing so many minutes. I mean, and honestly, that same can be said for a lot of the Knick players as we got deeper into the playoffs with all the injuries. The more those guys had to play, the more, you know, inconsistent those guys were becoming at some point. It's the same thing with Horford. You know, Horford's great for that 10, 15 minutes, but you start giving him 25, 30 minutes and you got problems going up and down the court. He's not the young guy he used to be, let me tell you.
No.
All right, so that's where we are. Right now, Boston's, what are they, down two?
They're down one or two.
They're down one or two right now. A couple of minutes left in the first half, so we're getting close to that point, to the halftime. Couple other NBA points. One is Danny Hurley goes back to UConn, spurns the Los Angeles Lakers, and says, I want to go back to college. I'm going back to coach UConn. Any thoughts on Kev?
The contract, you know, was a nice number, but I think he could make the same amount in UConn, to be honest with you, and not have to deal with the pressure of coaching the Lakers and the pressure of coaching LeBron.
Yeah.
I think, and also I think with, especially with Danny Hurley, he would have to change his personality too much to coach in the NBA.
I agree with that.
No, you get to the college where, boy, you know what, especially listen to the podcast. Darren does not like Hurley at all. I don't like him at all on the sideline either. Gino, I don't think you're not a big fan of him either.
No, I'm not.
And to me, when you're a college player and you can come in, especially with the transfer portal now too, and NIL, this, you know, guys coming and going, you could put up with Hurley for a year if it means winning a championship. And you know, his personality might be fine for a year or two. Then you're out of there. And you get some new guys in. But he can still bring the players. He's still a terrific coach. And, he's got a chance to go for a three-peat, which hasn't been done since John Wooden. So, you know what? Why not? He's still got to make a boatload of money. And maybe a better pro prospect comes up, you know, 3 or 4 years from now. Who knows?
Well, listen, if you're Hurley, right, and I'm going to say it this way, right? Theoretically, you're the front runner for any of these open jobs, right?
Yeah.
Well, other than LA and the Lakers, why would you go there? They have tremendous cap problems. They have issues all over the place. You're going to have to put up with the LeBron issue. You're going to have to put up with the Bronny issue, which is going to come up at some point in the next couple of months, right? Yeah. So, you know, if you're Hurley, Why would you do that? You know, it's one thing if you're in a college that is a big college and you haven't won, but after the seasons he's had there, why would he leave that to go do that?
You know, the soap opera that is the Lakers.
Exactly. Yeah. Listen, that's what I feel. I don't know why you'd make that choice, honestly.
Now, to me, two years down the road, the Spurs, Popovich retires. And you've got Wimbanyama. And, you know, the Spurs have a high draft pick this year. Let's say they go for one of the point guards, Shepherd, for example.
Yep.
And they've got building blocks. And in 2 years, all of a sudden, they're ready to take that leap. And Popovich says, you know, I'm 70, whatever. I'm ready to step down. That's a position that just seems ripe for, hey, I'm going to come in. He can be the hero. But this could be a team that is on the precipice of challenging for a championship for several years.
He'd also have young guys too.
Yeah. And I think it's been, like I said, I'm just throwing this out there as a Jersey example. But this is the type of situation I'd be waiting for if I'm Hurley.
Yeah.
Not coaching LeBron James for 2 years because But since leaving the Heat, let's be honest, you know, the coaching lifespan of coaching LeBron James is 2 or 3 years. That's it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. All right. The other NBA point is a sad note today. We lost Jerry West at the age of 86. He's the logo. He's the logo. 14-time Laker All-Star, 9-time champion as player and executive. 932 games. He averaged 27 points, 5.8 rebounds, and 6.7 assists. That's a hell of a freaking line. He did not have any NBA MVPs, okay? But he finished in the top five in voting 8 times. So we're talking about a superstar, Hall of Famer, absolutely. He's the logo. Any thoughts on Jerry West, Kev?
Yeah, like I said, 14-time All-Star, 10-time All-NBA first team, 4-time All-NBA defensive team, scoring champion in 1970, assist leader in 1972 when they won the championship, because only one as a player. In college, a 2-time All-American in 59 and 60. NCAA Final Four, most outstanding player in 1960. Like I said, the championships, 8-time champion as an executive, 2-time executive of the year, 3-time Hall of Famer, made it as a player in 1980, made it with the 1960 U.S. Olympic team, and was going in this year as an executive and consultant. He did everything. And if you could say if any superstar was ever overlooked, it might be Jerry West.
Yeah. And listen, he's the logo.
He's the logo.
He's the logo. Listen, I was talking to my wife. We all know my wife, not the big sports fan.
No.
And she said, and I said, I made a point. I said, yeah, Jerry West passed away, you know, the logo. And she gave me a look. And I actually pulled up the NBA logo on my phone and said, you see the NBA logo? That's Jerry West.
Yep.
So, all right. We'll move over to the NHL. The Florida Panthers are up 2-0. Florida cruised to a game one win. They wound up winning 3-0 in the first game. They got a goal in the first, the goal early in the second, an empty netter in the third. They were outshot in that game 32-18. And I bring that up because I got a point when we talk about game two in a second, but 32-18, they won 34 faceoffs out of 57. So they were winning basically 2/3 of the faceoffs that were going on. They were outshot immensely, didn't matter. Bobrovsky stood on his head for a good portion of that game. He was really good.
He was fabulous.
He was fabulous. He really was. Then we get to game two. Florida winds up winning 4-1. They score 4 goals after going down 1-0.
And the goal was almost a little weak. That was a 5-0.
It was. Yeah.
Ekholm scored. Exactly. Ekholm scored, you know, 11-17 into the first period, 5-0. And you go, boy, after standing on his head game one, that was a little bit weak goal allowed by Bobrovsky.
Yeah. Florida outshot Edmonton in this game 29-19, which is reverse of the first game. And Florida's grinding style just kept them, they kept Edmonton at bay the whole time. They forced them, even the shots they were getting, mostly shots were not great shots. Connor McDavid had a couple of breakaways. He could not get the puck. One of them, the defender came up and basically flipped his stick a little bit, so he never really got any good shot on it. But Florida's up 2-0, Kev. They're cruising right now. Now, if Darren was here, he'd tell you, can't say anything until a home team loses a game. So 2-0 going to Edmonton. We'll see what happens. What do you think about Florida-Edmonton right now?
We'll see what happens. I mean, the MVP for Florida so far, Bobrovsky, obviously. Bobrovsky,
game one. Absolutely.
And Rodriguez with 3 goals so far in the 2 games.
He's been excellent.
I mean, great. You know, third period, especially yesterday, it was 1-1 game. He scores early in the period, scores a little bit later on the power play, gives him the 3-1 lead. Ekblad with the empty netter later. But Florida, like you said, just what they've done most of the playoffs that we've seen, they play pretty tight for the first half of the game. If Florida's in the game halfway through, you feel like they're winning the game because they just keep coming and keep coming and keep coming. And with their depth and with Oilers so reliant on the top three, I mean, third period, once they were down, did Edmonton try to use a timeout? I mean, it felt like, you know, McDavid, Dreisaitl, and Hyman were out there, what, 90% of the time, it felt like?
Oh, absolutely. There's
no legs left at that point.
No, and they forced them to basically keep them off the ice for a minute or two here and there, because otherwise they'll be exhausted as they hit the 17-minute mark of the third. But, yeah, I mean, listen.
If Florida rolls through 3 to 4 lines.
That's it.
Then the fourth line plays enough.
Yeah.
And, you know, just the depth overwhelms Edmonton.
Yeah.
And, you know, game three, what's going to be key in game three is the first 10. It's cliche to say first 10 minutes is going to be key. I think Edmonton almost needs to come out so strong with the home crowd. They almost need to go up 2-0
in the
first 10 minutes.
I agree. I was actually thinking the same thing. They really need a couple of goals to just get everybody settled again.
I wouldn't be surprised if they go up 1-0 pretty early, you know, just with the crowd, everything else. If Florida withstands that and they're down 1-0 after one, I think Florida's got them right where they want them.
Yeah. I mean,
Edmonton really needs a 2-0 lead early.
Edmonton was up 1-0 in game two, and Florida and didn't just matter. Came back. I mean, you know. A couple of bad penalties, by the way, in that game. Yeah. A couple of 5 minutes. Listen, no major goal scored where it made this huge difference. It's not like, you know, there was a 5-minute penalty and they scored three times. That's not what happened. But a couple of these major penalties kind of forced, especially the one on Edmonton early, where it forced Edmonton, and on that power play, on that 5-minute penalty kill, those big guys don't go on the ice.
Yeah.
You don't see McDavid. You don't see Dreisaitl at all. You don't see Hyman. You don't see any of those guys. So when you get to that point, that's a tough beat for Edmonton, where they can't play any of those guys for a whole 5-minute stretch. But listen, Florida's up 2-0 right now. I mean,
if you're Edmonton, you might have to throw them out there at least for one shift during that time if they're in that situation.
It's funny you say that, because during that 5-minute penalty, Florida took a penalty, so they played 4-on-4, right? So we never got a chance to get to that third 4-minute mark of that penalty where we would have seen if those guys actually did come out on the ice. We never got there. So, but listen, they're up 2-0. At this moment, they're completely in control. I mean, Edmonton, they have to come out. They have to play strong in game three. They got to put some goals on the board. That's their game.
Well, you multiple. Know. Like I said, plural. Oh, yeah. Goals.
Absolutely. Listen, if you're an Edmonton fan, you want a 5-2 win in game three. That's what you want to feel good about going to game four. You win this game 2-1, you're going to be like, oh, man, you know, one of those goals went in and we lose game four. It's over, you know? Yeah. So we'll see how this goes, though. This is it's been a good series so far, though. First two games, Florida's played excellent hockey right now. All right, move over to baseball for a couple of minutes. A couple of points to start, which is Realmuto is out 6 to 8 weeks after undergoing knee surgery for the Phillies. Phillies playing some great ball. They're 46-20 right now in first place. Soto came back from his injury from last week. He's been playing fine, so I guess it was nothing major. Dodgers today, very concerned about Max Muncy not recovering quickly enough, made a trade today. I don't know if you saw it. They picked up Kevin Biggio from Toronto for a minor leaguer. Not a big move, but Biggio basically can do a lot of what Muncy can do. He can play second. He can play third. He hits for a little power. The way the Dodgers are playing right now, you know, he's going to hit probably eighth in the lineup. So it's not that big of a deal, but we'll see what happens with that. At this moment, we have 4 teams that are 20 games over 500, which is just insane. The Yankees, Baltimore, Cleveland, and the Phillies are all 20 games over 500. And when you take that and put it into perspective, you only have 13 teams, 10 teams over 500, right? So you got 10 teams over 500, and four of those are 20 over. This is a, the gap on these teams is really expanding. Yankees just playing really good ball right now. I'm not going to go into it deep today, but you know, they're getting the starting pitching, they're getting the bullpen. Verdugo looks like he's waking up a little bit. Grisham had a big day the other day with a couple of home runs. So that's where we stand. Judge at this point leaves the majors with 25 home runs. After a disastrous start, he now has 25 home runs. Yeah, Kev?
What are the odds of Judge setting the American League home run record again?
Listen, this is – it's funny. 2 years ago when he broke the record, right, he was at around this pace because they put the stat up. He's like one game off the same pace from 2 years ago. And then last year, he was on this pace until he went down with an injury. So, you know, theoretically, we're going into a third straight year where he's on pace to hit 60 home runs. It's ridiculous right now. It's just unbelievable. Mets at 28-37. Looks like they're going to get a win tonight, so they'll be 29-37.
They've got a 5-run lead, bottom of the eighth. Hopefully the bullpen can hold this one.
So listen, so we don't think they have played well at all up to this point, but a win here, they're 8-under. They have not got some of these guys back from the IL. Alvarez just came back. They've gotten absolutely nothing out of McNeil. You know,
Nimmo.
I mean, you know, Diaz went down. You know, Senga's still on the IL. I don't want to overdo it, but maybe it's not that bad.
Like you said, you know, you've got teams that are way at the top.
Yeah, that's it.
And the National League, it's, you know, the Phillies, the Dodgers, even the Braves without Strider and Cunha still. But then you get to that second, third wild card spot. The Mets are 2.5 out.
Oh, it's a complete toss-up.
And have not played well at all.
Listen, the NL has five teams at this moment over 500. That's it, five. Yeah. Philadelphia, Atlanta, Milwaukee, the Dodgers, and San Diego, who's 36-35.
So, they just got over 500.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. So, you know, they're not 40 games out at this point.
You know, the Mets need – the starting pitching needs to do something to step up here. You know, the last couple of days here, you know, they went overseas to London this weekend, got the split against the Phillies, which, you know, let's be honest. You have signed up for that last Thursday when they were going over. You said, we go 1-1, take it, no doubt about it. Of course, it took the first ever game to end on a ground ball 2-3 double play.
Listen.
To win the game.
We've seen stranger plays before. That's just up there with strange plays.
That's way up there. But the problem is that, you know, Manaea 3-2/3, Quintana 3-2/3. Last night was McGill 4-1/3 and lost to the Marlins. Even today, Peterson struggled to get through five. No, people are ripping on the bullpen. But when you're asking for 4 or 5 innings every night from the bullpen.
Yeah.
I've seen it too many times where, you know, the first three guys come in from the bullpen and they pitch well. And by the time you get to the fourth or fifth guy, they start giving up some runs. Well, law of averages, if you put five relievers in there, one of them's going to screw up.
And listen, again, at this moment, you're doing it with Diaz on the IL. So it even makes it a little bit worse because, you know, you figure you can get Diaz in for an inning and now you're covering another inning now. But yeah, I mean, you know, I think the big problem for me is that if they get to a point where they're, I don't know, let's call it 3 or 4 under at the All-Star break, but the playoff picture is similar to where it is right now. I hope they're not sellers.
Yeah. I hope they're not also.
I'm not saying that they're not going to sell a couple of these guys, but I hope they're not sellers. Like, I hope we don't see Alonso. Like, I hope we don't see some of these guys go, right? Because the way they are right now, that to me, they're close enough right now. I mean, they're not playing well. You figure once they start getting it going a little bit and have a good 20-game stretch, they got to put themselves back in this, right?
What you hit July 1st? You know, going into the All-Star break, they've got Washington, Pittsburgh, Washington, and Colorado. Not exactly a great stretch there. That's 14 games. Then you get into the All-Star break. And then coming right out of the All-Star break, you've got Miami, a couple at Yankee Stadium, Atlanta, then Minnesota. So, you know, that's going to be the stretch where leading into the All-Star break, those games that I mentioned, those are games that you have to start winning.
Yeah.
If they need to step up, they need to do what play to the back of their baseball cards, a lot of these guys. That's all you want them to do. Play to the back of the baseball card. If they can get 10-4, that gets right back in it going into the All-Star break. And all of a sudden, now you start looking, going, hey, are we buyers or are we sellers? Maybe we buy something. You know, maybe Senga's ready to come back. Yeah. Maybe you pick up an extra bullpen arm. You know, maybe Scott is coming up and is going to be, you know, a big help, you know, to this rotation for a little while until we get some more help.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Scott and Senga come back into this rotation. All right, maybe, you know, combine those with, you know, a couple of guys you got here. Maybe you got something going. You run off a 20-game, 30-game stretch where everybody plays well, you know, because at this point, that's kind of just what you need right now. You need a 15, 20-game stretch where, you know, you play 600 baseball, 700 baseball, just to get everything going in the right direction again. So,
yep.
Any other baseball points, Kev?
Nope, not for me. Pretty quiet right now.
Yep. We'll head over to golf. So before we get to U.S. Open, last week, Scottie Scheffler won the Memorial Tournament at Muirfield Village in Dublin, Ohio.
What? Scheffler won? I'm shocked.
His fifth win in 8 events this year. He took home another $4 million prize. tell me about Memorial, Kev.
11 straight top 10s for him. 5 wins in the last 8 tournaments he's been in. $24 million of total winnings this year. He broke the record he set last year at $21 million. It's June 12th.
It's June.
And he's set the record already. He is just incredible. Now, it's funny, one of the few times that he struggled the final round there, he shot 74, but it was a day that the rest of the field averaged a 75. So he still beat the rest of the field by a stroke. Only 6 players broke par. Nobody in the final 4 or 5 groups ever may put up a number to challenge him. He started with a 4-stroke lead, got down to 1 a few times, but he never lost the lead, which, you know, never. It was not comfortable for Scotty, but he never had to give up and all of a sudden, oh, I'm behind or I'm tied or anything. He always had the lead, and that was a big thing. Yeah. He's a great front runner, great closer, and does what he needs to do to win.
Yeah, I mean, he finished -8. Morikawa was at -7, and then Adam Hadwin was -4. So, I mean, it's not like he had 5 guys right on top of him. Yeah. He winds up winning the tournament. Listen, and that's the lead-in to this week. So, U.S. Open, Pinehurst in North Carolina, the 124th U.S. Open. Last time it was there was 10 years ago. Obviously, and this is not saying anything major, everyone is chasing Scottie Scheffler to start this tournament.
Yeah.
Scheffler has come in at +290 to win. Everybody else is way higher. And I'll tell you the odds that came out right off the bat. To finish in the top 10, everybody is plus, but Scheffler, he's at -275.
Yeah. Wow.
So thing to note is
he's +250 to win it.
Yeah.
These are numbers we haven't seen since Tiger Woods.
Yeah, absolutely. John Rahm is out with a foot infection. He withdrew from the tournament. The other thing just to throw out there is Rory McIlroy has 5 top 10 finishes in this event. I don't know if that comes into play or not. We're going to see. It's not like he's lit the world on fire lately, but, you know. Any points on the U.S. Open to start, Kev?
I thought the one interesting one, I mentioned it 2 weeks ago about Adam Scott, just as a just as a mention, just the fact that he didn't qualify. Well, he was number 61 in the world rankings. The top 60 are automatically in the U.S. Open. Well, sitting there at number 59, believe it or not, and you hate to think of it this way, but Grayson Murray, who, if you remember, committed suicide 2 or 3 weeks ago, he was number 59. He's no longer part of the U.S. Open, obviously, and I'm not trying to be funny, but that opens up a spot for Adam Scott to get an exemption.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, he probably would have gotten one anyway. They had enough other openings, but, you know, he's playing. It is his 92nd consecutive, I think, major. I think a second in history, only behind Jack, who made 146 consecutive majors.
His odds are 175 to 1, by the way.
Yeah. Other than that, you know, the when you look at it, boy, U.S. Open put together a hell of a threesome for the first 2 days. Scheffler, Schauffele, and McIlroy. Are they the three favorites?
They are.
Boy, if anybody's going to chase down Scheffler and put pressure on him, it's got to be one of those two. And right now, you know, the way he's been playing in majors for the last 10 years and, you know, over the last couple of years we've been doing the podcast, we keep waiting for Rory to do it. He hasn't done it.
No.
And I don't think he's going to do it again this year. I think he's going to be overwhelmed. I think Rory's going to struggle the first 2 days. He's going to be sitting there probably, you know, I'm going to say somewhere in the 20s. And then maybe do it good enough on the weekend. All of a sudden, he's going to sit there in, you know, the back door top 10.
Yeah.
And at the end of the season, you're going to go, oh, he finished top 10 in the U.S. Open. Well, he's never in contention.
He needs a good tournament from start to finish, Kev.
Yeah. I think Schauffele has a better chance of finishing ahead of Scheffler. I think the biggest thing for Scheffler, if he stays out of jail, this is his tournament to win.
Yeah. Only thing will stop him are the cops.
Yeah, that's right. make sure you keep everything in control there in Pinehurst.
Anything, anyone you like, I'll give you the odds.
Scheffler. He'd be my first, second, and third choice.
Listen, I'm gonna get to him in a couple of minutes with something else, but go ahead.
I mean the ones that you think of, Schauffele, of course.
Yeah. I mean, you know
Morikawa, of course. You know, you want to look at Oberg.
Oberg is plus 200 to finish in the top 10, and he's 22-1 to win.
The guy I mentioned a few times that I keep waiting for him to win, Fleetwood.
Plus 305 in the top 10, 35-1. If you like him, that's
a
good get. And the other one I know you always bring up is Sahith Theegala.
Yep.
Plus 450 for the top 10, 50-1 to win. So, wow. You know,
he's another guy that you feel like if he puts it together, he has a real shot here.
There are 15 golfers ahead of him on the odd side right now. So,
right.
You know, he's about the 15th, 16th best odds on the board, but because of Scheffler,
it's so skewed.
It really is. So I looked at a couple of top 10 combinations. Okay. So a couple of parlay combinations. Bryson DeChambeau, Rory McIlroy, plus 560. Right?
Wow. Yeah.
You want to go the Asian connection, Morikawa and Matsuyama, plus 950. Okay. Bryson and Koepka, plus 800. Åberg and Homa plus 1450.
Wow.
We're getting into some big numbers, right?
Yeah.
Xander and Victor Hovland plus 509.
Hovland struggled last week. That's, you know, he really played bad over the weekend. Otherwise, I probably would have mentioned him.
So here's what I did. So you're going to like this. So Bryson and Rory, top 10 finish, plus 560. Okay. It's a two-team parlay, basically, right?
Yep.
If I throw Scotty Scheffler in there and make this a three-team, it only goes up to $759. Okay? All right?
Wow.
Morikawa and Matsuyama plus 950. Add Scotty to that plus 1331. It's an awful lot. Okay.
No.
Bryson and Koepka plus 800, put Scotty in there plus 1127. It doesn't even pay to add up to this.
No, it doesn't.
Okay.
Let's try to get three of them up there now.
Yeah, his odds. But here's the thing, Kev, right? If you take Scheffler with one of these other top 10 golfers, basically, to get into the top 10, whatever their odds are to make the top 10 gets completely obliterated by Scotty Scheffler at minus 275 to make the top 10.
Minus.
You get like even money on a parlay. It's crazy. Right now, the Scotty Scheffler factor is something we haven't seen in a while. The last time was probably Tiger years and years ago.
Yep.
When it was like, I do remember one time, I was somewhere and the odds on Tiger winning the event were like, minus 350, and you can take the entire field at plus 110.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just crazy.
You know what? You're probably taking Tiger.
And you're taking Tiger. It was like one of those runs where he ripped off like six majors in six out of eight or nine or whatever it was. And it was just like, you want the field at plus 110, you want Tiger at minus 350. I think I'll take Tiger.
So
anything about this course interest you?
Well, Pinehurst has been notorious for its turtle shell greens, basically. So depending on exactly how difficult U.S. Open wants to make this. If you remember a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
I forget the last time or the time before that, where Phil especially, he could not hold anything on the green. The greens, they lost the greens. The greens are brown.
Yeah.
And when they put them on these impossible pin locations that you're smacking it up there. You know, you've got a 5-footer for par. You're hoping you're within 2 feet almost.
Yeah.
I mean, so the US Open has to be careful. They can't make the course impossible.
You want it to be very challenging for these golfers. You don't want to see these golfers at minus 15. Okay, for U.S. Open. But based on the information I saw earlier today about the rough looks like, some of this rough looks like it's going to be impossible.
Yeah.
So you know, at the same time, you don't want the minus 15. There's a balance, because what you don't want it to see, plus 12. you don't want the leader at plus 6 going into the third round. So, you know, you need this balance between difficult and challenging, but still playable. And we've seen it where sometimes the rough on this course is just like, just ridiculous. You know, it's like that. I remember that year with him too, where he just couldn't get it. It was just crazy.
It wasn't John Daly, I think it was, that, you know, didn't wait for the ball to stop rolling and hits it again and starts, you know, taking two stroke penalties just because he was fed up. But I mean, that's John Daly too.
Yeah. I mean, listen, the other thing is, you know, I'll give you the three that we always talk about. So Tiger is at 200-1 to win. Ricky Fowler is at plus 250 to win. And Mickelson is at 400-1 to win. So just to throw those are usually the three names we throw out whenever we're doing this. We go through some names, everybody throws a couple of guys, but at the end of the day, we always make sure we give you Tiger, Mickelson, and Ricky Fowler. So
the other big thing that's going to happen at this U.S. Open, 25th anniversary of the 1999 U.S. Open at Pinehurst. Of course, that was won by Payne Stewart. And a couple months later, he passed away in the plane crash. So, you know, being the 25th anniversary, especially, and at Pinehurst again, you're going to see a lot of things this weekend on TV, I'm sure, about Payne Stewart.
Yeah, absolutely.
On a lighter note, one other golf point. Gina doesn't know where I'm going with this yet. LPGA, just to bring this up real quick. They played the ShopRite Classic, and the only reason I know about it, they played on the Bay Course in Galloway, New Jersey, which I've had the opportunity to play on about 5 to 10 times in my life. three-round tournament. They do the cut after two. Linnea Ström from Sweden made the cut on the number, tied for 52nd. She goes out there, tees off at 8:20 in the morning, Sunday morning, sets a course record, shoots a 60. Second lowest ever, period, in LPGA history. She's done as the leaders are teeing off, puts up a number, has to wait 4 hours to see that nobody catches her, and climbs from a tie for 52nd all the way up to holding the trophy and winning
the
trophy. I mean, just one of those weird things that you go, wow, incredible. You sit around for 4 hours. I mean, if she ever's ever in a playoff, I don't know what you do to loosen up after 4 hours at that point. But, you know, that, she put up a number and nobody caught her.
That is something, let me tell you. Yep. Wow. Course record 60, huh?
Woo. Yep.
Woo. All right. Moving on. So let's talk French Open.
French Open. Women's side, real quick. Iga Swiatek defeats first Coco Gauff, 6-2, 6-4 in the semis. Then very easy, beat the 12th seed Jasmine Paolini from Italy, 6-2, 6-1. Third straight French Open, her fourth in her life, fifth major. She has spent all but 8 weeks in the last 2 years as number one in the world. She is by far and away the best women's player. More interesting on the men's side. Semifinals, you have the matchup between Oscar Alcaraz.
Alcaraz.
Let me say that. and Jannik Sinner. Jannik Sinner, with Djokovic losing early, Sinner is moving up to the number one ranking in the world. But Alcaraz beat him in 5-6. 2-6, 6-3, 3-6, 6-4, 6-3. Then he's got to come back in the finals, plays Alexander Zverev, and goes down 6-3, 2-6, 5-7. So he's down 2 sets to 1, comes back and wins 6-1, 6-2. This is Alcaraz's third major. He's now won Wimbledon, the U.S. Open, and the French Open. That gives him a Grand Slam on all three surfaces. He's the youngest player ever to win on all three Grand Slam surfaces.
Wow.
He's only the seventh to do it. The other guys you may have heard of, Jimmy Connors, Mats Wielander, Andre Agassi, Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, and now Alcaraz. That's pretty good company.
That is pretty good company, let me tell you.
He's only 21, and with the big three, you know, Federer's, of course, retired. Nadal, I think after the Olympics, he's probably done. And Djokovic, he's right near the end of his career.
Yeah.
It's Alcaraz now ready to step into that void. And Sinner, of course, he won the Australian earlier this year. It's going to be Alcaraz and Sinner to carry this forward for, you know, the foreseeable future.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And that's my tennis wrap-up.
Okay. I'll give you one other point, and that is a little jet information this week. So Aaron Rodgers had an unexcused absence from NFL mandatory minicamp. Although it was an unexcused absence, the coach was completely aware and okay with the fact that this was an unexcused absence from NFL mandatory minicamp. Kev, listen, it is June 12th, okay? So I can't take any issue with it because we're so far away from anything meaningful. But do you have any issues with this, sir?
We're talking minicamp? We're talking minicamp? He's been there most of the offseason. He's been doing a lot of the OTAs. Did he have to schedule this? No, probably not. He did. It happens. And, you know, with Reddick holding out right now as well, and he's got an unexcused absence. Well, I think just to set the example, you had to mark Rodgers down his unexcused absence. It's almost like we're back in grammar school.
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly what I thought of when I saw it, too.
But to me, you know what? I think, especially this early now, it gives Taylor a chance to work with the first unit, gives him a chance to learn the playbook, get involved with Hackett's offense. I mean, Rodgers knows it like the back of his hand, so I'm not concerned. It's
yeah.
You know, if it wasn't for the fact that it's Aaron Rodgers, it'd be a non-story.
Absolutely. And honestly, it is so early. And the fact that Saleh basically had to come out and say, yes, we talked about it. It is an unexcused absence, but we did talk about it. I mean, she already discussed it with him. I mean, come on. So that was the other thing that kind of popped up this week. NFL, we'll get into a lot of NFL as we get closer. Everybody's just beginning these mandatory mini camps now. People are just getting there. They're just getting themselves settled. We'll see where some of these things go, but I think we're too far away at this point to really talk about some of this stuff, other than the fact that this was Aaron Rodgers.
The only other fourth thing I could think of, I think this happened after our podcast last week. Caitlin Clark, not in the Olympic team. Any thoughts on that? Do you care?
It doesn't matter to me, but I'll tell you why it doesn't matter. And that is, she's only played, four WNBA games. There's a lot of deserving people, more deserving than her at this point. To me, I think they made way too much of it. But, you watch enough WNBA to really have an opinion that, matters. So what do you think?
I think given the eyeballs that she draws, I think you got to put her on the team. Almost like the Christian Laettner dream team spot in some ways, if you want to equate it to that. Okay. I think just with the eyeballs she draws, you've got to find a way to get her on the team. You're right. I mean, she's young. She's got plenty of years ahead of her to make the Olympic team. I mean, she's 22. She's easily got 3, maybe 4 Olympic teams to make in the future. So it's not like she's never going to make the Olympic team. I think right now, with her popularity, with the eyeballs she brings, I think you find a way to put her on the team.
I mean, I heard one other point. I'm not going to even pretend like this is mine. But somebody else brought up the fact, she plays for Indiana, right?
Yep.
If you are the Indiana front office, do you want her playing? She just got finished playing college ball. She gets drafted. She's in. Bang. She hasn't even gone through one WNBA offseason.
Yep.
Do you even want her out there?
From a front office perspective, probably not.
Yeah, probably not. And that's kind of when I saw the people talking about it, that's kind of what they said, which is, if I'm in the Fever, right? They're the Fever.
You're the Fever.
If I'm in the Fever front office, I don't want her. I really don't want her out there.
I have a fever and the only prescription.
But
anyway.
So you think for USA, she should be out there.
I think for eyeballs and for knowing that she's going to draw a crowd and draw TV ratings, I would have her on the team.
Okay. All right. Let's say
from a pure basketball perspective, she's young.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of good players on the team that you go, who can you take off to put her on? That's another question.
I mean, even if she's on this team, what is she getting? 4 minutes a game, 5 minutes a game right now? I don't know.
The guards that are on the team are phenomenal. So it's,
All right.
From purely a basketball perspective, will Team USA go out there and win the gold? Yes. They don't need her to win the gold.
Yeah. Agree. We're definitely the front runners far and away right now. So.
Yep.
All right. I think that's a wrap. You have anything else?
That's it for me.
All right.
Well, I'm going to try to do Darren's bit here. We are the Sports Kings from Queens. Like, subscribe, watch our posts on Facebook, answer, send us texts, send us messages, share our posts, do whatever you can, spread the word. We enjoy doing this every week. We enjoy talking to you. We want to hear from you. We want to know what you want to talk about. And to wrap it up, to borrow Darren's line, may the sports be with you.